Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, this is Laura Stark. I'm associate professor at Vanderbilt University and associate editor of the journal History and Theory. I had the great pleasure of talking with Lundy Braun about her influential book, Breathing Race into the Machine, The Surprising Career of the Spirometer, From Plantation to Genetics. The book was published in 2014 by University of Minnesota Press. Lundy Braun is at Brown University, a professor of Africana studies and a professor in the Department of Pathology and Laboratory Medicine. I had the pleasure of interviewing Lundy Braun along with students in my seminar, History of Global Health. A full list of students who are involved in the interview is available on this episode's website. I hope you enjoy. So thanks again for making the time to talk with us. And we're really big fans of your book, Breathing Race into the Machine. To start us off, I wonder if you could just tell us a bit about this instrument that the book is organized around, the spirometer. One of the most remarkable things in the book is the images that you show, and that the spirometer isn't an instrument that was a thing of the past, but it's actually the first image in the book is a present-day doctor's office in which we see a spirometer. So if we were to walk into a clinic and to sit down in front of a spirometer, what would we do? What would we be looking at?
Well, let me just first ask the group if they've ever heard of a spirometer before.
Yes.
So how many people have heard of one?
About five.
Oh, okay. Okay, that's quite a few. So it would depend a lot on the office you were going into. So this was from a primary care doctor's office, and my suspicion is that they're not quite as up to date. Not that that means that they don't do as decent a job, but as up to date as a pulmonologist's office would be. So I think for people who have had spirometry taken in a specialist's office, they would be looking at a different kind of machine. The machines now tend to be totally computerized and in many cases touch screen. So the operator will pull down on the or touch the race and any other parameter they have to input, they will do it through touch. Somewhat less new might have pull down menus, and then this, it was very clear there was a button, and that is the spirometer that was used in the office in 2005 or 6. I can't remember the date. So what you would see, what you would do, differs in some ways, but in all, you would have to blow into the machine. And then how much air you, after inspiration. So you'd first have to inspire and then expire into the tube. And so it would measure how much air after you expired, and then also the speed in a minute. So those are two spirometry values. There's many, many, many more. They're the only ones that are race corrected.
Right. So one of the remarkable things that you show is that the race correction isn't something that was in the 19th century built into instruments and just happened to get stuck into them. But actually, the race correction in the spirometer, the material of the spirometer itself, was actually a late 20th century introduction of the idea of a race correction. So to sort of start us off, Madison wanted to ask a question about why the spirometer.
Yeah, so of all the topics that could have been chosen, how and why did you choose the spirometer, especially when there are many other tools and practices that have had similar effects on race culture?
Well, it was actually very pragmatic. I describe how I came to the spirometer in the first chapter, where I was reading the newspaper and I came across this idea of race correction. And I happened to also be in a workshop on race and medicine with Evelyn, organized by Evelyn Hammonds. And I was also teaching general pathology to medical students. And so because I was in that workshop analyzing race and medicine, and it had come up periodically in my med school classes, that I just sort of looked at this article, and I was very interested in asbestos and asbestos diseases. And so as that conjuncture kind of caught my attention, and I wondered, how could this be? I actually didn't know anything about spirometry and wasn't aware of its importance, actually, as a diagnostic tool in asbestos-related diseases. So it was serendipitous. And then I started studying it a little bit with a friend who's a pulmonologist. And then it kind of morphed into a book. I never thought it'd be a book.
Well, we're glad that it was. And especially because you occupy such an interesting position as both a practicing scientist in a science department, and also you're in an African studies department as well. And so the first chapters of the book are really telling the history and the really interesting history of the spirometer. And there seems to be a moment in about the middle of the 20th century and the last three chapters of the book in which we see the debates about anatomy and pathology and the challenges over different forms of expertise really coming to matter when compensation, and especially workmen's compensation, becomes an issue in the three different domains that you're looking at. So the book is following these sorts of knowledges around the knowledges of lung capacity around the UK, Britain, the United States, and South Africa, as well as all of the colonial tendrils of the time period from the middle of the 19th century until the present day. And we really liked the way that you organized the book because you organize it around knowledge networks. So it's not a comparative study of these three different sites, but it's looking at how different forms of expert knowledge travel in between them. And the special role that the United States plays, particularly in lung capacity being racialized. In the spirometer, as you sort of point out in the first chapter, was credited with being an instrument that was developed in Britain by Hutchinson. And you point out that actually a lot of the tools and ideas had been around for about two centuries before that. But the spirometer came together when there was this convergence of precision instrumentation, statistics, and you specifically have a nice shout out to Ian Hacking's work. And then importantly, industrial capitalism. And industrial capitalism comes to figure in two ways, in which there's a need by the political elite for a workforce and a workforce that was cheap. But it also enabled the mass production eventually of these machines. So the industrial capitalism factor really worked in both ways. So in the context of creating a cheap, efficient, healthy labor force, efficiency was equated with what was called vital capacity. And that was basically reduced to be lung capacity. So you show us how in the UK, in Britain, the way that lung capacity was sliced when you looked at human variation was with occupation. But things really changed when this sort of information and data traveled to the United States. And you talk about how the spirometer gained what you call, referring to Lorraine Daston's work, you call epistemic authority. And here I'm going to hand the floor over to Ali for a question on epistemic authority.
In the epilogue, you mentioned the following. In each domain, racialization enhances the epistemic authority of the spirometer and of lung capacity the entity was purported to measure. Could you further explain to us what exactly you maybe meant by epistemic authority as a term?
Well, what I meant quite simply was that it became this tool that was relied on in actually so many different domains, and I never had anticipated this. I thought it was just going to be a medical instrument, and it was, and then it wasn't, and then it was again. But it had authority for producing knowledge. And, you know, to this day, it has tremendous authority. And what I'm arguing there is that it wouldn't have gained that authority without its racialization. Now, people could disagree with me, and, you know, there's never any absolute, quote-unquote, scientific proof. But by pulling together these various spaces in which spirometry was highly valued, physical culture or physical education was a huge surprise, and I certainly never thought I'd be doing having to research history of physical education. It turned out to be fascinating, and then Amherst College isn't too far away, so they had archives that I could work in, and it was delightful. But that was an area where I think it had a huge impact on the industry for creating, for manufacturing the instrument. So, you know, at the end, I'm looking at these various spaces. It is primarily used in medicine. And I think having your lung capacity measured is almost the first thing that would be done in a pulmonologist's office. If you come in with a respiratory, you wouldn't go to a pulmonologist without having some respiratory condition that the primary care doctor didn't feel they could handle it.
One of the key ways that you show that the spirometer and lung capacity, and therefore the idea of vital capacity, was racialized was in the category of whiteness. And so you show that in the early 20th century and then also in other efforts in the later 20th century, when the spirometer is basically being validated, the idea of what is a normal body and the question of what is a normal body, so what would be a normal lung capacity, only included data from white bodies and intentionally excluded non-white bodies as well. And it's interesting to see with these different professions that you bring into the book, the physical education in the early 20th century for producing the category of whiteness, occupational therapists, and really pushing against the assumption of the explanatory factor being race as opposed to environmental or structural political working conditions, that whiteness really mattered in producing an idea of what a normal body was, and the language, the vocabulary of race was removed from that conversation. Could you talk a bit about how whiteness came to play and came to be built into the spirometer?
So where I realized that was, again, you know, I never anticipated I would sort of come develop that concept, I was primarily looking at this as a comparative study. So, and then when I was deep in the physical culture, the physical education archives, there was no mention except very briefly a reference to Gould's work previously, which told me that they were, that at least forgetting his name now. How could I do that? It's not Hutchison, it's the other H. Anyway, the guy at Amherst. And I realized that what they were concerned with was they had these nice specimens of young males, many off the farms and in New England, and they were trying to mold them in all sorts of ways. And part of that was to figure out what was a normal body. What I don't quite understand satisfactorily is, like, why did they latch on to lung capacity? I mean, they were measuring lots of different things. They were doing anthropometry. But, I can't believe I'm forgetting his name.
Are you thinking of Hitchcock?
Yes, thank you. But Hitchcock devoted a lot of time and attention to the lung capacity measurements. And, you know, he wasn't doing much with them except at Amherst and comparing them and, you know, measuring them every year. But then in his speeches, a little, and he didn't give a lot of public talks, but in some speeches later, he would talk about the Anglo-Saxon male. And that's when I realized that this was really about whiteness and what is the norm. And ironically, that's still true because the norm for spirometers is always a white norm. So whether they're correcting by 10 or 15% from what they consider normal, that's population-based studies of whites. And then the other way they do race correction is do population-specific measurements, but still white measurements are always the highest. So, you know, I came upon that, again, utterly serendipitously.
Right. Yeah. It's really remarkable because you show that in the UK context in the late 19th century, it was intuitive just to see human variation. The relevant category was what one's job was, if you wanted to try to explain why there was variation in people's their health or in their physical comportment. But there's all sorts of other things that researchers also considered as explaining differences in lung capacity. So body surface, I think I liked the idea that somebody's body surface was the was really relevant, and that's what you needed to be collecting data on. Or people's height or their age or all sorts of other things. And the Americanization of the spirometer, really, it's just impressive that that's where race really entered in, and then especially was amplified in the South African context. You know, gender also seems to be important for thinking of the category of whiteness as well in the early 20th century, especially in physical education and occupational therapy. And so this is more of like a broader question for you, but why is the book a book about race as opposed to a book about gender? And I imagine this is sort of like a personal political answer.
Well, it's that I first came across it as a racial question. So in the lawsuit, it was male asbestos workers. I mean, most of the industrial workers, many were male, not all, of course, but in the plants in Baltimore, they were mostly male. So that's how I came across it. And the literature is, and the machine corrects for race. It also does correct in a certain sense for gender, but it works really differently. And I do address gender somewhat in the book, particularly in physical education when it came to be used in women's colleges. But I didn't, the book was getting too, I didn't want the book to be any longer. So I think a thorough explanation of race and gender would have been both unwieldy, but it's racialization is what sticks out, because for gender, you can actually, on average, women are smaller. And, so the correction doesn't seem wrong in the way that actually race correction seemed to me.
Right. And so the way in which it seemed wrong is that human variation could be explained in terms of structural and political inequalities. So especially in the Jim Crow South, for example, that the reason why there were differences, or even in South Africa, is that working conditions were different for different people, and that was patterned around race. And so the explanatory fact, by pointing to race as opposed to the structural political factors as driving the patterns, what really seemed to be a choice based on racialized assumptions. One also sort of broader question for you is, you seem very intentionally to use the language of racial instruments and racialized data as opposed to racist. And I wonder how you would encourage us to think about the careful choice in the word of racialized as opposed to racist.
So racialized, for studying the process by which race got embedded into the instrument, racialized gives us a sense of process. Of it happening over time and place. And I would, it depends on the audience I'm speaking to. I do think the consequences are racist, and that it is racist to continue to race correct, especially now that, there is information. I've also written scientific article on this, so it's not unknown. I don't use the language of bias. I don't believe I use that. I might have occasionally there, but
no, you
now,
don't use the language of bias. No,
yeah. So that's intentional. But here I was trying to get at process, that these things happen. They get embedded or attached to instruments by people who may or may not have any idea what they're doing at the time. It's pretty notable that the lung capacity measurements, not the instrument, but the measurements themselves, were only contested by Du Bois and then Johnny Myers in South Africa. So it pretty much nobody had raised questions except around the technicalities of the instrument. So that's what I was trying to get at. I do now, though, I do use the language of racism to describe what's happened.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
The book also shows and holds open these spaces of hope, the sort of the paths that were not pursued in terms of categories of measurement, or people who in the early 20th century and middle 20th century were actually suggesting that the relevant explanatory factor in human variation that was coming up in the data wasn't race, but it was environmental, by which they meant socioeconomic and political. But the way in which globalization and as a result standardization of measurements and also the categories as well as the instrument of the spirometer, the standardization was really important in having race, as you write, built into the machine, where it becomes what Bruno Latour would just call a black box, where nobody opens up the instrument to see what the political assumptions are that are built into it at all.
Right.
Looking back at some of your data, your empirical evidence that you pull up, that was most striking for us is the actual quotation, why lung capacity, that a researcher around the turn of the 20th century in the United States, importantly, in the Jim Crow South specifically, said that it was well understood that, quote, two causes of difference in human variation in illness was, first, the less lung capacity and the smaller brain size of people of different races. And so there's so much research, historical research on phrenology. But what you're showing is that along with phrenology was this idea of lung capacity really being a key index of the reason why researchers thought there was an innate difference in the United States. And throughout the book, the U.S. seems to play a really important role, even when the context of the United States is stripped out of the data as it circulates through these knowledge networks. And so on this point, Ashley is going to follow up about the place of the United States and where that leads us.
Okay.
Yes. So it's clear in your arguments that the scientific research we've come to accept isn't always a reflection of reality. So now that researchers are more aware of this construction of racist categories of collecting data, how can U.S. researchers in particular help reconcile this?
Well, you know, unfortunately, we continue along the pathway of looking for genetic differences between races. So, you know, it is somewhat discouraging, but also not surprising to the people who've been doing this work for, you know, three decades, really, that would improve knowledge, start to change things. I think Nancy Krieger has a statistic that I think is useful about how much NIH invests in genetics research around race versus studies of racism. And I think she did this maybe 2005, and it was 500-fold difference. So it does pose a very simple question that, you know, you don't get answers to questions you don't pose. And if you're looking for genetic differences, you know, it just is a machine now that keeps looking for genetic differences. So I don't quite know how to answer that. I like to think that the waters are being troubled some, but there's also a major marketized industry attacked attached to genetics research that makes it more difficult to turn things around and say, you know, we should be studying something different.
Yeah, so genetic tests being sort of the more present day contemporary with the spirometer, which continues to exist with the race correction in the present day, as contemporary or similar to genetic testing. And I like your phrasing that you don't get answers to questions you don't ask, which is why the categories through which variation is explained seem to matter so much. Not so only partly the actual measurements, but the way in which the questions are conceptualized in the first place. And we too were big fans of Nancy Krieger, and a critical epidemiologist. She's at Harvard Medical School, is that right?
I think it was School of Public Health.
School of Public Health. Yeah, that's great. So thanks for that shout out. Another shout out I wanted to make, and actually to think about how the material aspects, by which I mean when money comes to the front of all of these questions, the spirometer really pulled to the fore in the United States, that compensation around workplace disability and also life insurance seemed to be one of the very early places where who was owing money to whom really brought the spirometer to center stage. So I wonder if you could just talk us through the case of the Prudential Life Insurance Company and their head statistician, which is also a case that knits really nicely with Dan Bouck's work on in his book, How Our Days Became Numbered. But could you tell listeners a bit about the Prudential Life Insurance Company and their role in all of this?
So I don't think the company itself had a huge role. As it turned out, for the life insurance industry, including Metropolitan Life and Lewis Dublin, Lewis Dublin sort of dismissed lung capacity as a key measurement for insurance purposes. What's interesting about Frederick Kaufman and Prudential is that he made his career off the book, The Race, Traits, and Tendencies of the American Negro, and that truly nobody could view as anything but a racist diatribe. And it's just a hideous book to read. His book is really hideous, and then Samuel Cartwright's work is really hideous. But he wrote that book before he was chief statistician, and what it looked like to me, he was promoted on the basis of that book, and then he went on to serve for 40 years. Addressing questions of race, interestingly, he was very pro-worker, but not if it was black workers. His views about race never left, but I think for the companies, a spirometer was just too much, to a technology that was beyond what they could use on a mass basis. So it was really this individual, and he's who Du Bois and Kelly Miller responded to. So I don't think it became a really important measure of anything at Prudential.
Okay, around the turn of the 20th century,
right at that period.
Yeah, in connecting that with our earlier discussion of the use of the term racist versus racialized, I can also imagine when you engage different audiences around that vocabulary and have to choose your language carefully, that the idea of saying that something is racist suggests that there might be a few individuals that you could just get rid of and then everything would be okay. But the real persuasive power of this book is showing how the instruments themselves build in, they don't allow people to not ask a question about racial difference. The instrument itself forces the question in the present day. And let you leave open really, really nicely the spaces and opportunities for us to have hope, because you show us places of contestation where scientists, for example, in the UK, aligned with workers' movements to try to get better forms of compensation using the spirometer. And then also even in South Africa, how there were health professionals who were aligning with the union workers to try to work towards greater social justice. And so you're also a scientist, and we really like that, because we want to try to imagine a world in which change is possible, but not necessarily through running away from problems, but actually engaging them and trying to work from the inside. And so Isabel is going to follow up on this issue.
Throughout the book, there are several instances in which you talk about eugenic and anthropometric data and how they were either not published or they were considered inconclusive. Yet a lot of these studies are still cited in the present day to support the process of race correction. So we were wondering, as a scientist yourself, how do you personally orient your work and your research, knowing that these instruments have political and cultural biases built into them?
Okay, so first of all, I'm no longer a practicing scientist. So I was, and I was trained, but as I moved into the field of science studies and Africana studies, it wasn't possible to actually do this. I couldn't have written this book as a full-time practicing scientist. There just wouldn't have been the hours in the day to become acquainted with the kinds of debates I needed, to historiographic debates, et cetera, that I needed to know about. So I personally am not incorporating them into scientific practice. I do understand, you know, at least some of the science as it gets more computational, of course. I don't understand it and nobody understands it, but my hope is that people, younger people, who are practicing scientists can imagine how would you actually start to think about research on something, an object like this, without re-inscribing those categories over and over and over. So that, you know, that is what my hope is. It is challenging, though, for the reasons I said earlier. It's quite challenging. I have a class full of students who want to be able to do that. So we'll see how it works.
Yeah, no, that's great, because it's also so important, especially when you're showing in the last three chapters of the book that it matters in the nuts and bolts of the legal system and who is compensated for injury, and basically trying to understand the causes, sort of the distal, the structural causes of differences in health. So
the interesting thing about in South Wales, when the mine workers union was operating, is that they were so invested in objective knowledge. So I think there's a real something that need culturally, scientifically, that needs to be wrestled with is there an instrument that can do all the work we're asking something like the spirometer to do? I mean, is there this objective way of assessing bodies that are complicated and changing?
Right. And I think of people like Sandra Harding doing work on rethinking the category of objectivity for things like strong objectivity, and despite people's dissatisfaction with that. But yeah, the history of objectivity, there's been so much work on and thinking of the different forms of expertise. This has been really tremendously interesting and helpful for us. And to sort of wrap us up, we want to think a little bit more with your help about what the future might look like, what it could look like, given that we're, except for me, I'm old, a classroom full of people just starting off in their careers in healthcare, in social activism, in different sorts of fields. And Margaret is going to take over from here.
So through your analysis of the spirometer, and we are able to conclude that instruments can have racist biases embedded within them. Obviously, everything is politicized in some way, but with this in mind, is there a future in which racist tools and metrics don't exist? If so, how can we actively work towards this future?
So I do think it is possible to examine how racism got embedded through seeing, and that's what I hope that my book and the article that is part of the project can show. How did racism get embedded in the machine? What was the process of racialization that by which it happened? And then just start to recognize it elsewhere. So there's a lot in the press in the last couple of weeks about an algorithm that discriminated against blacks. There, the algorithm didn't even use race as a input, but nonetheless, it discriminated. And so now people argue that all you do is need to tweak the algorithm and this will all go away. I don't think it's that simple. But so we, first of all, have to accept that racism is deeply embedded in science and medicine, and that in the U.S., the U.S. can lead in certain areas like this. So another example that I'm working on is kidney function and race correction of kidney function. And so there, the history is quite different, but there are so many examples, and actually they're proliferating right now between algorithms, calculators, et cetera. So I do have some faith that when we get more students into scientific specialties and then in medical specialties, that the questioning will begin to unsettle things. The thing that, you know, certainly you all have to be aware of is that, you know, medicine in particular is extremely hierarchical. I mean, it's more hierarchical certainly than science. And so the possibilities for questioning for students can be difficult and have consequences. So that, on the other hand, I do see more, because I work in the med school, I do see more students questioning, and then they'll go on to be practitioners and continue to question. So it really is a matter of thinking there's a problem in the first place that needs to be questioned. And what many are reluctant to acknowledge is that that the U.S. is a deeply racist society, and that science and medicine are implicated in that pretty profoundly.
Well, imagining otherwise, it's especially here in Nashville, Tennessee, is what we're trying to do together. And you were a great help for that in thinking about this. And the issue again that you really emphasize so well is that it's not simply language. So in the debates about whether language creates the world or matter creates the world, of course, it's an interaction, an intra-action between the two. But that the idea of non-white things, that people, bodies, measurements that are non-white are pathological. Mm-hmm. Is so clear in the evidence that you show in this history of the spirometer. And we'll look forward to reading more, thinking more, I hope talking more with you about your own work, and looking forward to critically examining algorithms, machine learning, and the new ways in which race is being built into the machines of medicine.
Exploding.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Well, it was really nice. I'm always thrilled to hear student questions, because I don't usually teach my own book. So it's special to hear the kinds of questions that the book generated. And I appreciate doing this interview with you.
Well, thank you. And there's so many more questions in there, and I hope that listeners will check it out with their own questions too.